Well, hey there, freaks. It's your boy Marty Bent here to introduce this week's sponsor. Probably already know what I'm going to say. You already know all about them. The Cash App, the number one finance app in the App Store for the last 2 years. The first P2P payments app to let you freaks buy Bitcoin. They're also helping you save money at local merchants with their Boost program. When you get the Boost card, you can go to Chick-fil-A, Whole Foods, your local coffee shop, Taco Bell. I believe Domino's is on there as well. The list goes on. It's only growing. On top of this, you can easily send money to and from your friends. I've actually had a lot more friends ask me to Cash App them recently over other alternatives, which has been cool to see. And if you guys are buying Bitcoin and stacking sats on the Cash App as well, you can send that out to a personal wallet once you're ready to take your personal financial sovereignty into your own hands. So go to your local app store, either the Google or the Apple App Store, and download the Cash App today. Hope you freaks enjoy this episode with Alex Gladstein. I know I certainly did. Alex is fighting a really good fight with the Human Rights Foundation and the Oslo Forum. And I think he's got a very, very strong message. So I recommend you listen to this episode intently and take the words of advice from Alex to heart, because this is a battle for freedom at the end of the day. Enjoy. Tales from the Crypt. What is up, freaks? Welcome back to Tales from the Crypt. It's your boy Marty Bent here on a rainy Monday. Deep into Hell Week already, it feels like. Blockchain Week started Friday night. It's only Monday afternoon, and it's been a long weekend already for me. My guest today has had an incredible weekend. He gave one of the best speeches at the Magical Crypto Conference, in my opinion. I'd like to introduce you freaks to Chief Strategy Officer at the Human Rights Foundation and the Oslo Forum, and also a guest lecturer at the Singularity University, Alex Gladstein. Alex, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be on. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming, man. Again, going back to your speech, I was telling you earlier, I was fanboying a little bit. You provided some of the best introductory content to normies, I believe, on Saturday with your presentation at the Magical Crypto Conference. We're going to jump into that, obviously. But first, as is par for the course here, Tales from the Crypt, how did you find your way to the Human Rights Foundation, working on Bitcoin in particular?
Yeah, so my background in human rights dates back to 2007, when I was still in university and I was in London working for the Liberal Democrats as a research assistant and studying at the School of Oriental and African Studies. And I put in an application for an internship with some new organization called the Human Rights Foundation, which had been created the year before, which was focusing at the time pretty heavily on Venezuela and Cuba and other kind of human rights issues in Latin America. And I got the internship and spent a few months that summer there putting together backpacks of outside information and movies and books, which would then be smuggled into Cuba. Because in Cuba, the government does not allow you to have any books that they don't approve of ahead of time. So you can't have anything that's not kind of in their particular philosophy. So we would send in stuff like Animal Farm, 1984. We would send in movies like V for Vendetta.
And
I remember putting this together really vividly. This was the time of burning CDs and DVDs, and we would put together what looked like somebody's like basically CD collection, Britney Spears and Bush and whatever. But in reality, around the little sort of transparent ring in the middle, we would write in very small font like what it actually was. And it would be, you know, whatever it was, like some Woody Allen movie or Braveheart, et cetera, The Matrix, et cetera. And these would go in with my colleagues who were Latin American, so they could totally fine go to Cuba. And they would meet up with folks in their homes, give them this stuff, and then it would be accompanied with like a Spanish language kind of like some sample questions. And our kind of contacts there would host these little 3-4 person meetups where they would watch the movie and then have like an open conversation about what that meant. And this was something that was looked upon very favorably by the civil society community and the underground library community in Cuba. Eventually, as the years went by, satellite technology became a little harder to like control. And now today you have this like Paquete system, which was really well covered last summer in a Wired big cover story.
I remember this story.
Yeah, folks like smuggle in a satellite receiver, basically download everything on Spanish Netflix or whatever. And then they put it on a hard drive and they basically pass it around the community and people take off what they want and they pay for it. So the work we were doing is a little outdated at this point, but it was quite vital at the time. And it gave me a real sense of how, you know, information is power.
No, especially in these countries where information is subdued and suppressed, it's interesting to see how the black market sort of routes around it. And this example in particular, the paquetes?
Yeah, the paquetes. This is like a hard drive that would contain like, you know, contraband or forbidden information. And, you know, from Cuba, we ended up bringing some of these folks to our first Oslo Freedom Forum sort of event that we held in Norway in 2009, which was meant to be like a gathering point for all sorts of troublemakers and dissidents and whistleblowers. And we had some North Korean defectors there too. And they were like, hey, we're doing something really similar. We're like smuggling information into North Korea using balloons. Can we trade notes? Do you guys want to, you know, team up, help us out? So a few years later, we started to go to South Korea to meet them and assess their needs and bring philanthropists and technologists and media and journalists to understand like what they were working on and why they thought it was so important. This led to a Wired cover story and a lot of amazing media coverage. I think the story was done by Andy Greenberg, one of my favorite journalists who actually covered a lot of Bitcoin's history. I think he was like one of the court reporters in like the Dread Pirate Roberts case, right? Mm-hmm. So Andy ended up going out there and interviewing all these folks and going on the ground, you know, in that region. And he did this cover story that I think was called something like, you know, the plot to topple Kim Jong-un with a thumb drive or something like that. And it was just this incredibly vividly detailed report on how North Korean refugees, you know, gather at the border in China and at night, like, you know, send things over this river into North Korea where these flash drives filled with movies and books and stuff would be sold and distributed and traded. And this is like a very popular thing that happens there. And it's only grown in its phenomenon since. So that's something I worked on quite a bit at the Human Rights Foundation. And then over the years, we started to do more like hands-on digital security training for journalists and activists and dissidents. We team up with folks like the Electronic Frontier Foundation or the Tor Project. They would come out to our events and meet journalists and activists from different countries and talk about how they could be more safe online, encrypted messaging, VPNs, stuff like that. And then over time, inevitably, I had been introduced to the concept of Bitcoin in around 2014 by Brock Pierce, who I was on a houseboat with in Ephemeral, a festival that takes place off the in the Sacramento River Delta.
A houseboat with Brock Pierce?
It was fun. Yeah, it was great. So he kind of got it on my radar. And that summer, Mark Anderson wrote this piece for the New York Times, which I tweeted about then and I thought was super, really well done.
It's still to this day
is one of the best articles in the mainstream media about Bitcoin. I mean, I don't know what he's doing since then on it, but it was really well written and it really captured my imagination. But I didn't really put two and two together until 2016 when a guy named Bill Tai, who was in Bitcoin from the very beginning and was mining in his apartment in Palo Alto in like 2010, and has been around for a long time. He was the one who introduced Richard Branson to the concept of Bitcoin. And this is why Bitfury has that thing on Necker Island. That's mm-hmm. like cryptocurrency conference there. So Bill had made that connection and Bill was on the board of Bitfury. And Bill said, hey, and this was like September 2016, and he said, I'm on this, I'm involved with this organization. Maybe there's something we can do together to help people who are in like broken economies or something like that. So we ended up putting together just a small program at our Freedom Forum, you know, that following spring. And I remember being shocked because this was in May of 2017. So the Bitcoin price was going from like, $1,200 to $1,500 to $2,000 kind of while we were sitting around that week in Norway. And it started to get on a lot of people's radar, you know, initially.
Sort of like this week
or sort of like December 2017 or whatever. But it was very exciting and it was cool. It was so convenient that we actually had Bill there. And I think, you know, there was some initial interest there. And then that kind of led me down the rabbit hole where in the last 2 years I've tried to work to understand how the Human Rights Foundation can help people through our work to help them sort of access the world economy, to help understand how Bitcoin can be a tool of liberation, and to maybe work with organizations and companies to do some like research in the field to help understand why and how people are adopting this new financial tool.
Yeah, now you mentioned Mark Anderson's piece in the New York Times being one of the best mainstream media pieces. I was like, yeah, I agree. And I was like, but after thinking about that for 15 seconds, you wrote probably another one in Time Magazine earlier this year. That blew up and really drove home sort of the benefit of Bitcoin from a human rights perspective.
Yeah, and it's I had the benefit of hindsight of a lot more years of watching it succeed. But mm-hmm. It's funny, I'd been working on that piece for a few months with the encouragement of a few friends of mine. And I write frequently in the mainstream media about general human rights issues. And my friends at Time were happy to run it. They were excited. So it happened at the very nadir, like the very bottom of, it was like, Bitcoin was like $3,300 or something at that point. And I think one of the reasons it went so viral is that people were kind of bummed out. And they were like, this is what we're actually in it for, you know?
Mm-hmm. No, it was in, so let's jump into what you talked about in that piece in particular, right? It's
Bitcoin as a liberation tool from broken economies, from dictatorship, from financial surveillance, from price fixing, from hyperinflation, from restrictions on your bank account, on withdrawal limits, all these things which you kind of may notice as like individual phenomenon, they're all part of this like financial repression like idea, right? That governments use to control people. And I say this in a non-conspiratorial way. Like, I'll just put this out there. I'm like someone who believes in good governance. I'm like a fairly proud American. I think our government does some really great things in the world. I think we have some problems. But generally speaking, I'm not anywhere close to like an anarchist or even really a libertarian. I'm more of like a progressive person. But I just witness so many crimes happening and so many injustices happening on the financial side that the human rights community, the progressive community, just for some reason kind of just doesn't really think about or doesn't look at. You know, we've of course looked at like corruption, but you know, who owns money and who creates money and who gets to control money is something that I never even thought about, even after working in this field for like many, many years until I sort of saw it through the prism of Bitcoin, right?
Isn't it crazy? Because like money is it's the root of all evil. Money runs the world. It's sort of the center of everything in culture and music, sort of pop culture, stuff like that. It drives the world. It's always talked about, but until Bitcoin, people really haven't questioned sort of the essence of money and what it is.
Right. And it's interesting because when I was writing the piece for Time, I was thinking about how both in the 90s and 15, 20 years ago, and again, like 10 years ago, sort of this sort of online digital freedom cypherpunk folks had been trying to explain why privacy digitally was important, right? Trying to explain why PGP was important. You know, folks like Phil Zimmerman, John Callis, some of these like legends, right? They worked so hard. John Perry Barlow, all these folks with EFF, like trying to fight to explain why we needed to have privacy on the internet. And we had already gone through numerous narrations of why encrypting our communications was a good thing, right? Not that, you know, unlike the establishment when they were first confronted with the idea of secret communications, they totally missed the point. It's not that bad people can all of a sudden communicate or the dictator can suddenly communicate with his accomplices. No, the whole point is that the million people that live under the dictator can all of a sudden now communicate without the dictator knowing, right? That's the real point of encryption. So we had already gone through this narrative of like, hey, everybody, here's why like communications privacy is really important on the internet. And the EFF and so many other organizations have already gone through the hoops on that and shown us how to argue that, right? And it just seemed so interesting that we were now going through the exact same thing again, just with money. In the same way that it's important for us to have digital communications privacy, it's important, it's even more important for us to have digital financial privacy. I was listening to a podcast the other day, and well, maybe it was a few months ago, and there was a British journalist who studies sort of money and payments, and he was saying something that I thought was really pithy, and he said that sort of our spend or our spending habits say more about us than our words, right? And I think that's true, right? So if you care about your privacy and you were somebody who fought for encryption, or you thought it was cool that people could now use Signal or Wickr, you should be really interested in Bitcoin. Because if you're not, you know, we're going down this road where money as a technology is evolving from metal money to paper money to you know, credit cards that represent the paper money to our phones, which then operate that system, to now social media companies, which are going to be the future of centralized digital money. And that's going to be a nightmare for our privacy. And you need to think about how this really amazing community of global brilliant people are building a decentralized digital money that has privacy potential, major privacy potential. And I know we're not there yet, but seriously, like, the door's been cracked open for this possible world where, like, in 20 years, your family and your kids and future generations might still have financial privacy. And if we fail, I really think we're screwed. Because, I mean, these people are so thirsty for your data.
That, and so if we do fail, there's already examples that exist in the world that have sort of come to be because of a failure of fighting for freedom, and China being the main example. And in your talk on Saturday, you touched on Weibo and how that platform in particular is the data net.
For WeChat in particular.
WeChat.
Yeah, I mean, look, when I in the timepiece, I tried to break down briefly some examples for people to understand how this could matter for folks. So one, of course, is surveillance, right? So we look at China. We look at how most people in urban China, hundreds of millions of people, potentially more than a billion people every day, if you look at some of the data coming out from Tencent, you know, using this app every day. And just to explain to the average sort of maybe American who's listening, this thing is like as if your Amazon and Netflix and Google and Chase and Foursquare and email and
Postmates.
Instagram and all of it is in one app, right? So it's kind of like you're using Facebook or whatever, but Facebook's got Venmo in it and you never leave the app, right? So it's got this incredible ability that companies don't have here in the US yet, thankfully, to create a perfect sort of digital footprint of your life.
It's almost like a panopticon.
Well, I mean, in some cases, that's the goal, right? I mean, the Chinese government would like to have pretty full knowledge about what its citizens are doing in a granular way so that it can use big data analysis and machine learning and AI essentially to sift and sort through all that data to disincentivize and punish, if need be, any potential dissenters and reward loyalists, right? That's the whole idea, is to create this climate of self-censorship and to create this climate where the most loyal people to the Communist Party are really rewarded in such a way where you would never think of even saying something against the government. And there was that amazing quote from 1984 that I used in the presentation about at the Magical Crypto Con about how, you know, the only thing you owned was the few square centimeters in your head, right? Mm-hmm. And that's really, you know, the truth in some areas of China today, right? Especially in other, and it's not just in China. This has been done before without technology. So, for example, in Mao's China or in North Korea today or in communist Cuba, you know, in very repressive environments, even pre sort of modern technology, governments were able to use informants and spies to monitor the population. You know, we know about the Stasi Germany, right? The East German dictatorship. There, one out of every 50 people apparently was a spy. Mm-hmm. So what this has allowed governments to do is to, like, basically make that process so much more efficient. So rather than having, like, one out of every 50 people walking around kind of trying to listen, and rather than, like, sort of relying on people who could be, like, patriotic in a real sense and decide to not spy, now they don't have to do that because they can rely on you. And something that Yuval Noah Harari, the author, says, which I think is really spot on, is that these algorithms, these things like WeChat or even Facebook or Amazon, you know, collectively they know more about you than you do. Like, when you're watching Netflix, you don't need to, he says this, is funny, like, you don't need to sit there and argue with your wife or whatever about what you want to watch. It knows what you want to watch. It's showing it there. You know, you could argue for an hour, but it's showing you right there. Like, you know, Foursquare or whatever, the you know, you don't need to know what you want to eat. It'll tell you what you want to eat. So think about that in the hands of, like, a repressive government, right? So kind of this is where we are in China, and that was one example I wanted to bring, because if we could start to, like, have a global neutral financial network where we could transact, you know, in a way that would be more difficult to achieve that marriage of financial and personal information surveillance that's like really good for humans. Another example, of course, is hyperinflation. So whether it's the Zimbabweans or the Venezuelans or the folks in Somaliland, a small country in the Horn of Africa, or in Iran, this allows people to have access to a currency that the government can't just print more of arbitrarily.
I was, even though I've been following this sort of process for years now in Venezuela, I was still shocked to see the price of a cup of coffee and priced in Bolivar. Bars from 2016, 2017, and 2018. Like, I thought it was bad in 2016 already.
Like, it was. I mean, it started a few years ago. But in this, again, this isn't a new phenomenon. Like, I think the world record for hyperinflation is Hungary in the 1960s or something like that. I mean, this has been happening in the 20th century, you know, dating back to pre-war Germany, right? So we have many examples of this. And again, this is a particular lifeline for someone under that situation. Okay, then you might have sanctions. And here's where it might get interesting for Americans, because look, again, I'm like fairly proud to be an American, et cetera, but like we do some dumb stuff abroad. You know, why should the average young Iranian entrepreneur who definitely didn't vote for her government, why should she not have access to be able to buy Apple equipment or to not be able to transact with friends abroad? I think that's bullshit, you know?
Oh, I do know. Like, I've had Iranian expats come study in America, and I've taken classes with them, and I've had Iranian friends at points of my life, and they're some of the nicest people I've ever met. And it's
of course.
I think that's who I think of when I think of the sanctions, is the people that I've met personally. Sina, kid
right.
My age. Like,
and there's compelling arguments for us to focus on smart sanctions, meaning to focus on individual criminals as opposed to broad populations. And Bill Browder has done some amazing work with that, with the Magnitsky Act. So
makes a lot more sense, right?
I'd encourage you to look into that. But generally speaking, Bitcoin gives folks an escape valve from like arbitrary sanctions on their population. And another example that I think is really, really relevant from my work when I'm looking at helping people who are civil society organizers or NGO leaders in like difficult regimes, let's say in Russia, you know, what does Putin do when you are a human rights watchdog or an independent journalism organization? He wants to like restrict your movement, restrict your ability. I mean, he shuts down your bank account. I mean, he's got control over that. He can't do that anymore. I can now send Bitcoin into Russia. There's a lot of local liquidity, you know what I mean? And those folks can turn that Bitcoin into local money. And that is something that is starting to happen in so many countries around the world. So this idea that like governments can restrict the flow of finances to civil society organizations, especially if we're teaching good operational security to folks and they understand how to most efficiently turn Bitcoin into local fiat, I mean, that's a lifeline for sure. Right?
Yeah, no, and the Lightning Network torch proved it. Like, we went from Wales to Iran to Israel, almost went to Gaza after that.
30,000 feet in the air.
Right.
Right. So that one, I think, is key. And then the last example, I mean, there are more, but the one that I thought was always strikes me as really important is this idea of identity. And I know we can go down like a side path here, but basically, in a country like Burma, you know, the government has an incentive to sort of like delete people off the record. So it's this highly nationalistic regime which tries to scapegoat minorities, like Muslims, for example, right? So we have a situation where the Burmese military dictatorship basically deletes or, you know, purposely loses or destroys the records of citizenship of Muslims. Like, I have a friend of mine, this happened to her, right? And she was a political prisoner from the age of 18 until 25. She spent 7 years in prison in Burma, and then she escaped. And she was able to visit one of these camps that basically the Burmese government has forced into existence by, you know, chasing the Muslim minority Rohingya population out of the northwest corner of Burma into Bangladesh over a river. And there's all these amazing photos on the internet of how brutal this is, right? All these people stuck in these camps.
What is their justification for this?
It's just hyper-nationalistic, jingoistic, like, you know, persecution, you know, getting everybody excited about nationalism. Mm-hmm. There's like this Buddhist nationalism there, and they're preying on religious minorities. Every dictator needs an enemy. Every dictator needs a boogeyman. So the boogeyman of this particular regime are the religious minorities, not just the Rohingya Muslim groups, but the Karen people and all kinds of people all across Burma. So the government's like super intense about destroying these people. So these folks have been like, you know, taken off the identity system, and they're now sitting in Bangladesh in a camp, and they don't have a passport or an ID, right? I've asked her, like, you know, did most folks there when she visited, did they have, you know, paper IDs and stuff? But no. Was there internet access in the camp? Intermittently, yes. Are there markets in the camp? Meaning, do people come in and buy and sell things? Of course, Bangladeshis come in and buy and sell things every day. In any refugee camp, this happens, right? People come in, buy, sell things, leave. There's like a market that develops. Of course, in places like Jordan and Lebanon, where there are these massive Syrian camps, or in Kenya, where there's massive camps of Somalis, there's like a lot of this market activity going. So you could easily start to think about, with the proper education, we could have a situation where you can have a Rohingya family that doesn't have a passport ID, has no way of making a bank account, but if we can get them a cheap burner smartphone with access to the internet, you and I can send them non-KYC Bitcoin on like a bread wallet, and they can then take that to somebody who's particularly enterprising, let's say in the market, who realizes, damn, I can make like a nice cut if I accept Bitcoin for goods and services. And all of a sudden, you've got like a little market going. And this would allow us to completely sidestep the entire messy, corrupt, slow foreign aid process. We could just go peer-to-peer with people. And they don't need some passport. They don't need permission from a government. That, to me, is like one of the most compelling parts of Bitcoin.
And it's very compelling, right? Because there's, I mean, foundations typically get a lot of slack for not being the best allocators of the funds that they receive, correct? So that's...
Yeah, and look, like, I think most people generally in the foreign aid business are you know, have noble intentions, but when you have a system whereby there are so many middlemen, and, you know, at a base level, it's like, if you're a foundation, the Gates Foundation, U.S. State Department, whatever, you're trying to help somebody abroad, you've got your bank, you know, so it's already, it's you, then your bank, then SWIFT or some sort of global coordination network, then the bank of the person you're trying to help, and then the person. I mean, you've got like four or five different degrees of separation here, probably more, right? Whereas, like, we're talking no degrees of separation. We're talking a direct peer-to-peer
post an address, gift. We'll send you funds, right? It's that simple.
Yeah, exactly. And we can coordinate it, you know, peer-to-peer on messaging. So, and this is not something that currently governments are looking to stop, which is kind of an interesting idea to play with on its own. But, you know, a friend of mine was saying that, you know, when she visits China today, which of course would be one of the governments you'd point to as like the most draconian when it comes to digital communications, that she can receive, you know, like non-KYC Bitcoin onto her phone, and then within minutes, you know, be shopping it and trading it on these WeChat groups and then get renminbi for it. Like, the liquidity is pretty easy to come by there. And you're starting to see that it's not just in, let's say, advanced technology societies where that's possible, but in many different places. I mean, I've been doing a podcast series, like an interview series with Adam Levine over the last few weeks for his show. And we've been interviewing people from all these different countries and learning a lot. I mean, it's so cool. You should definitely check out this upcoming series that's coming out next week.
Speaking to people from Nigeria.
Yes, we interviewed folks from Nigeria, Iran, the Philippines, India, Hong Kong/China, and Venezuela. And we were talking to them about, like, first of all, why did they get involved? You know, some of them are researchers. Some of them are businessmen and women. Some of them are entrepreneurs, some of them are educators. Like, you know, why did they get involved? How do folks access Bitcoin and why? And it was so interesting. I learned so much. I mean, a couple teasers would be like, because I want you to listen to the series, but just a couple teasers would be that, I mean, it's amazing the Bitcoin dominance in these countries. And like, I'm not like, I love Bitcoin, but if something came along that was better, I'd be like on it. You know, I'm here for the freedom aspect of it. But to understand the network effect that it already has, and that this is like 90-95% Bitcoin in these countries. So, I mean, that's something to think about if you're like, how can I help? Well, I mean, you probably should start by seeing how we can make the existing infrastructure better, right? And then the other thing that was really interesting was understanding this idea of like liquidity time. So, for example, again, if I send like non-KYC Bitcoin to you, you know, whatever, 2-3 confirmations, half an hour. It's with that other person, right? How long does it take from the moment that it hits their wallet and is confirmed to when they can be holding local currency in their hand or in their bank account, right? And this is like 15 minutes for some of these countries, even less for some. And, you know, it sounded like no more than even like a day, even in particularly difficult countries like India, where they're really cracking down on cryptocurrency. It sounded like you could do this, generally speaking, within a business day. And, I mean, that's just extraordinary. I mean, especially when you think about how long some of these wires and Western unions and international kind of money transfers take to process. And we're doing it in a way where no one has the opportunity to say, no, we don't really like you, so we're just not going to let that one go through, you know? So we're not only doing it faster and more in a streamlined fashion, but we're also doing it without the opportunity for crony censorship.
Yeah, and it's like something you touched on earlier is like China and Russia, they have the ability to stop these transactions pretty easily if they want to via tracking. They can censor at will. Do you think Bitcoin is, like, obviously it's playing catch up against these systems? Are you optimistic about where it is on its path compared to what we're fighting, right? Because, like, obviously, like we just said, like, China is the, on one polar end, like, this is the worst case scenario that we could end up in, and we're actively fighting against that future outside of China.
I think there's a couple different viewpoints here, right? I mean, I think you can take the point of view that, with a defensive technology like Bitcoin, it's always going to be easier for individual developers to kind of like stay a little bit of ahead of surveillance. So that's like one potential outcome, right? And people like Adam Fiskor, who created Wasabi Wallet, like they tend to have this philosophy, like, oh, like he's like, within a few years, this is going to be very, very difficult to trace, right? On the other hand, you have others who are like, don't underestimate, you know, Mossad or you know, the NSA or the Chinese government, like, don't underestimate them, right? So we have this kind of like, some people who are a little more optimistic, some people who are a lot more pessimistic about, let's say, government's ability to restrict us from sending each other Bitcoin. And I think we need to consider all views. All of them are viable. All of them are possible. I think there is a world where Bitcoin continues to grow in certain ways, but becomes practically unusable because it's either the risk of owning it or using it is so high. And I think we need to do whatever we can to kind of make that world not a reality, right?
Yeah, no, you yelled at me over the weekend via Telegram that we can't fuck this up as Bitcoiners.
Yeah, it's been really amazing to be at the at the Magical Crypto Conference. Usually I speak at events where, you know, that aren't crypto events, where people are, you know, don't know very little, they know very little about Bitcoin or any sort of cryptocurrency, right? And I'm trying to explain to them, you know, what it is, what are some of its attributes are, why it exists, how it functions, etc. So to get to speak to an audience of some of the most sort of world-class builders of Bitcoin was really fun. And also other projects too. Like, I think other projects are awesome. Like, all about Monero and Zcash. I think private money is really important. Not necessarily because I think people are going to use it all over the world, but especially because, like, we need all kinds of cutting-edge people working on private money. And, hey, at least at the end of the day, they'll keep the Bitcoin people more honest and you know, keep them more on schedule, right? So to come together with this community was super fun. I think everybody's kind of, like, into civil liberties and at their heart, if they're actually there for an ideological reason, if they're into Bitcoin or Monero or Zcash. Obviously, they care about privacy, and they don't like the surveillance state, right? So it was fun to hang out there and do a talk that hopefully gave folks some insight into what would happen if they screw up, and just looking more into kind of what's happening in China. Again, the world's largest country. This isn't some Black Mirror episode. This is something that's happening, and it's not just happening in China. This stuff's being exported all over the world.
So that's what I wanted to get into. So two things. One, first, like you said, it's becoming to the point in China where, like, if you interact with quote-unquote undesirables, you're going to hurt your social credit score. And so you're just basically, via the social credit score, creating pariahs in society, which is a scary thought.
Yeah, and just a note on that. I mean, we should be under no illusions that that's something that's happening kind of en masse across the country in a unified, cohesive way. But it is something that's being experimented with in certain cities and by certain companies. And it's absolutely something the Chinese Communist Party would love to see across the country. So while we need to take everything, I think, coming out of China, especially in the English language, with a grain of salt, because, you know, there's just, you know, a lot of sort of conflicting reports about exactly what's happening. I think what we do need to know is what their intentions and goals are, which they've been quite clear about, you know, and that's that they want to have things like that happen. They want to have people who are low on social credit, let's say, not be able to access key financial services, because that allows them to run a regime which is protected by self-censorship as opposed to active censorship. It's way easier if all of your citizens are afraid to rule. If they're not afraid, it's very difficult to rule arbitrarily, right? So I think that's kind of the goal there, and that's something we hopefully don't ever have to see in other countries.
No, and then second point, going back to your point about China starting to export this is one thing that you mentioned and talked about briefly in your presentation, but Belt and Road, a $1 trillion investment project to basically export this technology to countries around the world, Latin America, Africa in particular. So $100 trillion project, $400 billion of that has been deployed already.
$1 trillion project.
Yes, $1 trillion.
Yeah. And to give you like some historical context, so the Marshall Plan, which rebuilt Europe after World War I, in like today's dollars, I guess, would be something like $120 billion, right? So the Chinese government has already given out $400 billion in investments and loans to like more than 100 countries all across South Asia, Central Asia, the Middle East, Africa, Latin America, and now Europe, right? And I think that's the kind of the maybe the most chilling part for people who are from America or Europe, because we think, oh, it can't happen here. Even when I show them stuff about, look, this like Ecuadorian government, there's this amazing New York Times investigation into this about how the Ecuadorian government in South America is, you know, using Chinese technology to surveil the population. And you've got...
Did Correa let that happen?
So basically it started under Correa. And look, I know that the current president... The current leader of Ecuador is actually much better on human rights than Correa, much less authoritarian. But still, I mean, as we know, even in open societies, think about the Brits or the Australians, they're like super intense about creating a digital police state, even in democracies. So it's something that everybody needs to be worried about. But when you look at some of these other countries too, like Zambia, so I have a friend who just went there. When you get off the plane at the airport, at the capital, everything's in Chinese, all the signs. So there's quite a lot of this neo-colonialistic kind of like Chinese infrastructure and loans sort of system being set up all across the world. I mean, Burma's essentially a colony of China at this point, where they harvest all the, you know, teak and rubies and all kinds of resources, and they abuse the local population. But to get into Europe, I mean, the fact that like Italy and Greece, Switzerland, I mean, Italy was the first G7 country to be a part of this thing, the Belt and Road. Switzerland, Monaco is allowing Huawei, you know, to build their 5G network, right? So all these countries in Europe are about to like basically auction off the rights for the building and the construction of the 5G networks, right? All in the next 18 months. This isn't something happening in 5 years, it's happening right now. And, you know, you talk to some telecommunications officials in these countries and they're finding it very hard to steer their decision makers away from the Chinese companies. They just have better tech. They're ready to deploy it now. Why not, right? And it's difficult to argue why not.
What is the pitch? Is the pitch like you're going to be able to surveil your old population? Could the argument why
no,
not
well,
be
no,
like?
It's that like there's tremendous business pressure to launch and set up 5G for commercial interests in all countries. I mean, I know there's some health concerns, but generally speaking, which obviously should be explored more, but generally speaking, the idea is we're going to have gigabit speeds on our phones on 5G networks, right? And it's going to totally change the way that like public infrastructure, health, you know, networks, payment networks, all this stuff kind of works, right? Now, I can tell you, if you care about your privacy and civil liberties, you don't want the Chinese Communist Party's like apparatchiks building your 5G networks, because they're going to build it in a way that's very, let's say, malicious for your personal privacy.
Hey, you showed one example of a Chinese policewoman wearing Terminator-like glasses where she could literally just like look through them, their electronic, and read people's social credit score as she's walking by.
Yeah, and some of that, again, is like an experiment at this point. I think the New York Times did a story that was pretty good where they were saying that like at this point, some of this stuff's more Kafkaesque than Orwellian. Mm-hmm. But certainly that photograph is of a policewoman who a year and a half ago or so was testing such a device. Now, I'm not sure if it was certainly at the time like working at scale. I mean, maybe today it is, but at the time, the idea was that they're testing these technologies so that when they're police officers, and they're, I think at this point, they're up to 700 million surveillance cameras in China. So the goal was to be at 1 billion by next year, by 2020. So there'll be almost as many surveillance cameras as people in that country. And the goal is that these cameras are like integrated in some way across a standard where like when your face comes up or your movement, your gait like comes up, that you get sort of identified, and then, you know, they can easily, you know, figure out whether or not you are a potential troublemaker or not. I mean, that's clearly the goal. I mean, we don't know where we are in the implementation of that, but in some places a lot closer to reality than others. And this is street level facial recognition tech is what these other countries are buying, like Latin America, Africa, et cetera. Like whether it's, again, Zambia or Ecuador or Panama, I mean, that's what these countries are buying. And these European countries seem pretty excited about surveillance. I mean, I told in my magical CryptoCon talk about this story of the Danish banker that I met last week, and she
couldn't explain why she wants to know everything.
Yeah, I had this conversation after giving a talk to a bunch of like telecom and banking folks from Scandinavia, and in the Q&A after, she was like, well, I don't think we have enough information about our clients. And I was kind of like, well, like, what else do you want to know? Like, is there a limit? Is there a line that you would not want to cross with regard to collection of personal data about your clients? And she couldn't answer me. I mean, again, these people are so thirsty for your information and your data. And even if they're good people individually, it's like the banality of evil thing. They just want it all. Because they think it's going to result in a safer society. And that's this like huge misconception. But they really want it all, and they will take it from you if you don't fight for it.
Well, I think Bitcoin is an incarnation of the fight for that freedom. But going back to the exportation of this Chinese technology, you were alluding that there are Western companies helping them do this too.
It's pretty stunning.
How's this happening?
One of the things we do at the Human Rights Foundation is go to South by Southwest every year, and we try to put together some programming to intrigue the sort of creative tech classes that go. And if you haven't been, it's awesome. You should totally join us next year. We're probably going to do some programming along these lines of like how Bitcoin and cryptocurrency are maybe like providing some lifelines to folks around the world. But anyway, this year we decided to focus on this issue of the prison camps in Western China. And we brought in someone who had escaped from these camps. His name's Tahir Amin. He's a Uyghur Muslim minority guy. And a couple years ago, he had gotten out. And now he lives in the United States as a refugee. And we put him on stage, and I got to interview him along with like two journalists who'd been kicked out of China for reporting on this issue. And it was a pretty stunning revelation, I think, for the people in the audience who had no idea this was happening. I mean, there's probably 1.5 million Muslims in these prison camps, and nobody seems to know. And what was so crazy is that Tahir was profiled by the Times a couple months ago, and before he left, his DNA had been sequenced, like taken from him, right? Cheek swab or something like that. And the Chinese Communist Party is building this huge DNA database of all these Uyghurs. And this was broken. The story was broken in the New York Times, and I got to ask him about this on the panel. And look, you know, we can call it conspiracy theory. You can call it whatever you want. In my opinion, these sort of theories need to be proven by the Chinese Communist Party that they're not doing these things. But a couple examples of what he gave as to why they would be doing this. I was like, well, why are they collecting all your DNA? So he kind of gave two reasons. Number one is organ harvesting. So you know that the Chinese government does a lot of organ harvesting of prisoners, things like that. This has been in the news for a long time.
I did not know that.
Yeah, so
this is news to me.
You can just look up organ harvesting China. Like it's common knowledge that the Chinese government harvests organs from prisoners and things like that and sells them around the world. Well, in the United States, what's a liver cost? What, 800 grand? Like this is a very lucrative industry, right? And there's not a whole lot of regulation around the space. So this is something you can look up. I mean, there's like British government, American government, all kinds of government reports on this. Now, what was horrifying to me to learn was essentially that what Tahir told me, and again, you know, you can look this up and figure it out if it's true or not for yourself. I'm not sure. I think the burden of proof should be on the Chinese government, not on us. But essentially what he says is that he's got sort of like testimony and like kind of eyewitness evidence that what the Chinese government is doing is providing halal organs. Okay, so they're like rich Saudi and Emirati princes and royalty and rich folks who, when they get sick, they want a Muslim liver or kidney or whatever. And they're willing to pay double. So they're willing to pay like $2 million for like a Muslim organ, right? And they buy them from the Chinese government, who harvests them from the prisoners in Xinjiang.
I did not know.
Now, you'll never be able to forget it. It's like this jarring idea. And, you know, is it happening? I'm pretty sure. I mean, I'm trying to figure it out, but it's certainly something I could use some more help on. So if folks want to dig into that, that would be great. But it was stunning for him to say that. And of course, like the more obvious thing is that if you're a Chinese Communist Party official and it's, you can basically like put your freaking thumbprint on a screen and then order an organ essentially from the prison camps, like that would be pretty convenient, right? So that's his like first reason for why they're doing this. The second one was even more sinister, and he's basically saying they're creating a bioweapon that would kill all the Uyghurs but not other people. And I was just like, okay, I mean, that sounds pretty dystopic, but is it really
a
worse?
A bioweapon that could what?
That would basically target target folks with like certain characteristics, mm-hmm. right? And not others.
Well, see,
that's his theory. I mean, again, we're getting into like stuff that I'm not going to say this is happening or not. It's what he told me. But again, I think that the burden of proof needs to be on the Chinese government to basically come out and say they're not doing this. Because I don't know, dude, they've got millions of Muslims in prison camps, and what they're doing is cultural genocide. What they do is they take the men and they put them in the camps, they take the wives, they marry the wives off to Han Chinese men, and then they take the kids and they change the identity of the kids to Han Chinese. So they're literally doing what they did in Tibet. They're doing cultural genocide. You never hear anybody talk about Tibet anymore. I mean, Tibet's like a done deal. The Chinese government was victorious in Tibet. So what they're trying to do is do the same thing in Xinjiang to the Uyghurs, and they're using this highly advanced technology to do it, right? And a lot of that, at the end of the day, it rests on financial surveillance, right? So again, we need to come up with ways to preserve our financial sovereignty and our financial privacy, or else I'm afraid, folks, that the slippery slope ends in prison camps. I'm just afraid that that's where it goes.
It's shocking to me, too, because even 60, 70 years after the fact, 80 years after the fact now, or yeah, 60, 70 years after the fact now, after the Holocaust and like the trauma that's brought up with that, we have a genocide going on in Yemen. We have these internment camps in China, and it seems that the world is sort of a little bit quiet about the modern
Syria,
day genocide.
Congo,
Syria. Yeah.
Yemen, Xinjiang.
What's going on in
North
Yemen?
North Korea.
Is disgusting to me. Like, as an American, is like the fact that America.
Yeah, we should be helping the Yemeni people.
We're financing their.
It's a disaster.
It's a famine, officially, right?
It's a disaster. It's hard to know, but I have some friends who just went there, and we should be trying to help save these people as opposed to support the Saudi dictatorship and MBS, who are horribly corrupt and evil. But, you know, we do what we do. So, look, I'm not in the politics game here. I'm not trying to blame or point fingers, but I would remind folks gently that no matter what side of political side you are in the United States, that both Democrats and Republicans have been super guilty on this one. I mean, like, Hillary Clinton was taking tons of money from the Saudis, and you go back to George H.W. and W., both loved the Saudis. You know, Obama wasn't much different, and now you have Trump. So, like, no matter where you are politically, I mean, dude, they're all going to take money from the Saudis. So the important thing is that we, as like non-political folks, let's say, stand up and speak out. And it was kind of alarming when Jamal Khashoggi, you know, the Saudi journalist and writer, was murdered. I had met Khashoggi. He was a guest at the Oslo Freedom Forum last year. And it was stunning for us to hear about what happened. But even more stunning was that a couple weeks later, there was like a big business conference in Riyadh, right? And this was an opportunity for like businesses, like American businesses who don't have any, you know, they're not voted on by the American, you know, they're not trying to like deal with foreign policy. They're just trying to sell their products. They had an opportunity to take a stand and basically say, no, you know, we're not going to support the Saudis. And they didn't do it. They claimed they did, but like a bunch of them went anyway, you know? And I think what this industry, the let's say the, we'll call it the crypto industry, regardless of what project you're working on, like, I mean, I hope you're working on Bitcoin or something related to Bitcoin, but regardless of what you're working on, like, you need to be very careful about what conferences you attend, what you support, what you're building. Like, don't build a smart city, which is a euphemism for a surveillance city. Don't build a blockchain project or a cryptocurrency for a repressive government. You know, don't build something that's going to be used to create a database for people. Don't build a blockchain project that's going to be like storing all this data for like vulnerable people on it. That's not a good idea. Don't do any of these things. You know, build things that can help preserve our privacy and our data and money sovereignty. And this is really important, and it's an opportunity for you all to take an ethical stand where our political leaders are failing, right? And where our traditional business leaders are failing.
Well, that most importantly. And then second, when these governments and corporations are able to harvest our data, they're terrible at storing it. Like you pointed out Equifax, you pointed out was it India or China's DNA program that had a breach, where everybody's DNA is on the market now. Like from an OPSEC, from a security perspective, like the world that Bitcoiners are trying to build, just probably makes more sense and spreads out risk.
This idea that we should be all uploading all our data and sharing it all over the world has dire consequences. A colleague of mine mentioned this today. Like, was it Strava? The kind of like a fitness tracking app that decided to like put all the data onto this like big global heat map. And again, as an American, this was interesting because apparently what had happened is that what was visible was like exactly where U.S. military bases were.
Yes.
You would see this, like in the middle of the desert, you'd see all this activity. So regardless of kind of where you are, like this is a bad idea. Like, let's not have this like massive, like sort of like neon sign that's displaying where we are and what we're doing at all times. This tends to be a bad idea. And it matters. Look, it matters for money, I think, kind of primarily, because that's kind of like the infrastructure for a lot of the way we network and communicate as humans, but it also matters for other stuff. So look, I'm here to talk about Bitcoin, but you know, I'm also really interested in zero knowledge cryptography. I hope there's a day where, you know, my data on my phone can be sovereign to me and I get to disclose who gets to see it or sell at my pleasure to whatever companies I want, as opposed to them just taking it and just, you know, doing whatever they want with it. You know, whether it's my location data, financial data, health data. You know, and maybe these like lightning based apps can kind of like show us the way to maybe a near future where that can be possible. I hope so. And again, there's like a tremendous amount of responsibility on folks developing this stuff. And they're not getting they're getting no mainstream media support. They're being attacked by the mainstream media. Generally speaking, within the crypto industry, they tend to be black sheep. Like they're doing it for their principles, generally speaking. I mean, there's certainly some bad characters even in the Bitcoin space, but like generally speaking, these folks are like kind of ideologically committed, and a lot of them are making less money than they could be, you know, working for Google or whatever. And they need our support, right? And they need our moral support, financial support, emotional support, whatever, because they got to build this stuff. Because if we don't have like reasonably scalable, usable financial privacy, we are toast.
Yeah, I would concur with that. And so things like what Willow Byrne and Casa, not together, separately, are thinking about like WebLN and using basically hardware and node to act as a digital passport is something that's really appeasing to me. It's something, like you said, you only disclose and release information when you want to. You basically go around using cryptography saying, hey, I want to interact with this site. All right, I'll let it see.
Yeah, and there's several people who've talked about this idea. I think Jack Mahler's did on one of Peter McCormick's podcasts, but this idea that like maybe like your Lightning ID essentially would be kind of like your avatar, right? Like it's how you would use to interact with video games or whatever, and you could build a reputation with it. But it doesn't have to be linked to your personal information. It could be an avatar. But that's such a compelling idea to me, right? And it's something that I think I'd love to see more iteration on. It's a brilliant idea.
You can build multiple
reputations. Yeah, you can have a whole bunch.
Exactly. You spin up a bunch of nodes. You have your gamer node. You have your finance node. You have your...
Yeah, and I just look, at the end of the day, you get a lot of pushback from people being like, oh, well, like, you know, if we have anonymity or pseudonymity or whatever, like the world's going to end, or, you know, all these bad things are going to happen. And again, we saw this argument happen before with the rise of the internet and the rise of private messaging. I mean, did the world end? Like, is it much worse off than before? No. In fact, like, it's I think arguably, demonstrably better on like nearly every front. I think open systems that allow people to do things, you know, according to their own, you know, rights and abilities, are so much better than closed, arbitrary ones where you need to ask for permission for everything, and where your rights can be taken from you. I mean, I think a quite simple parallel on this would be like the idea of like the open democratic society versus the totalitarian one or the dictatorship, right? Like, if you were to ask a young person, like a child, you know, what's more safe, the society that has like all the guns and all the rules, or the one that has like a lot less rules and a lot less guns and people kind of do their own thing? You know, the child would usually say something like, oh, I'd rather live in the one with a lot of rules and a lot of guns and a lot of police. But that's not the way it works. It's counterintuitive. Like, basically, terrorism and corruption breed in like very tightly controlled societies, like Syria, for example, obviously. Whereas like much more open societies, even though they have flaws, but like, let's say like Switzerland or United Kingdom or Japan or whatever, Costa Rica, they tend to have a lot less of those problems because they're open, right? Because there's like social trust and all sorts of really cool attributes that come out when we have freedom, right? So this sort of idea is holds with knowledge as well, right? We used to all live under like controlled knowledge environments where, you know, before the printing press especially, like only a handful of people could control knowledge, right? And then the evolution of the technology of information went from the printing press to the telegram to the radio to the television to now the internet. And now it's like everybody can hold all the information in the world in their pocket. It's tremendously important. And you really see this come out in places like North Korea. Like, this is amazing. And it holds again, I think, for money, right? And that's like the big question. And that's what I believe, but you know, we aren't sure yet because we're at the brink. It just happened just a couple years ago, right? But now we can have decentralization of money. We can distribute money, and hopefully people can all get involved with it, as opposed to like some arbitrary elitist group being in charge. And I think that this idea that we can all kind of own our financial destiny or whatever won't trigger more criminals, won't trigger more bad behavior. In fact, I think it'll lead to less corruption. Peer-to-peer interactions and a more market-based sort of digital economy, I think, will lead to better decision-making for humans. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's my working thesis at the moment.
No, I would agree, and this is actually a great segue into the end part of your speech from Saturday, where you analogize Bitcoin as a modern day peaceful Manhattan Project, right? So you're talking about, you think this is going to change sort of the dynamic of how people work together, like nuclear theory, like nuclear war theory changed game theory on the geopolitical level forever. Like, now that everybody has nukes, like, it's most likely that nobody's going to launch one because the world would end, like, right? That game theory. If we get Bitcoin to a point where it's ubiquitous and out, that creates a new game theory too, where it's like, hey, but it's a peaceful one. It's a more peaceful theoretical situation.
We'll take that in two ways. One is that it is cool. It's sort of like this peaceful Manhattan Project where like all the smartest people are, without coercion, coming together from across languages from around the world to build this like sovereign, arguably, hopefully, private money project. Like, that's amazing. But the second part is it does have those geopolitical effects. And this is what we're observing, right? So in the same way that like, oh, now there's like deterrence and, you know, owning a nuke, like, arguably may prevent violence. And there's all these interesting ideas, right, in that geopolitical field. Now, like, governments are faced with, like, what do we do? What would happen if we banned Bitcoin? I mean, there would be economic consequences for that. It's not like when a government just bans the internet or shuts it off. I mean, there are economic consequences for shutting off the internet, obviously. But they're much more grave and immediate for shutting off an economic network, right, that connects their citizens to the world. So the longer that governments don't attack, the harder it will be for them to do so in the future. As long, if these businesses across China and South Asia and Africa and the United States, I mean, if they become more and more and more legitimate and more tied in to the way that people do things, they'll be a lot harder to root out. And if a government decides to go all draconian, you know, to all go just like, let's torch it all, you know, basically it'll drive out a lot of innovation to competing economies. And I just don't believe in this world where 180 or 90 governments somehow one day agree, like, miraculously, oh, we're all going to ban Bitcoin at the same time. we're all going to make possession illegal. Like, they're not going to do that. There's going to be three or four random island nations that are going to say, oh, we're actually going to keep it open. We're going to be open for business over here, and y'all can come here. Well, and we're gonna take advantage of all that entrepreneurship and all that innovation. So it's just not going to happen.
I don't even think it's going to be like island nations. Like, the U.S. and China are in a trade war right now. I can see one trying to dick over the other and just be like, fuck you, we're going.
Right, and this is why Bitcoin at the end of the day is so much more than a technology. I mean, it is, but it's way more than that. It's this incredible socioeconomic phenomenon that, like, is going to change the way that nation states deal with each other, is going to change the way that, you know, businesses deal with each other, and is going to change the way that nations and individuals interact when it comes to money and transacting value and storing value. And that's kind of really why I think it's very exciting to live at this time. I mean, if you're a believer that this is something like, whether it's sort of the printing press or the steam engine or, you know, something that, like, transformative for society, then we're kind of, you know, at this brink where things are going to be different later, you know? And I think we have all the reasons to believe that that's true, and that kind of where we're headed is very, if not exciting, at least mystifying, you know?
Definitely mystifying and inspiring. Again, this is something I've said a lot last month in particular, but it is like Bitcoin has provided a common mission for people around the world to sort of join forces. And I wake up every day with a sense of purpose, like writing the event, doing this podcast.
Look, and it can be very inspiring. And, you know, look, I try to do my best to stay relatively even-handed. It's difficult because I think I'm very excited about Bitcoin. But I wanted to ask you, what could go wrong? Like, what if Bitcoin really succeeds? And what if all of a sudden in the near future or in the mid-near future we have the ability to transact seamlessly in any sort of denomination to anyone on Earth or anyone connected to the internet without having to reveal our identity? I mean, what, like, I just want to play with that for a second to appease all of our critics, let's say, or to perhaps give them the benefit of doubt that they're actually right. Have you ever thought about that? Like, what do you think? What are the bad things that could happen? And I'm asking you this so that we can start to think about how we can prevent those things from happening, right?
Yeah, so if we don't get sufficient fungibility, I think we could easily remake the systems we're trying to run away from. That's number one.
Right. So if we don't have, if coins can be tainted and tracked too easily.
Yes. That's
now, how does that relate to light? Like, what if all of the transactions are happening on second layer?
That's right? It's good for us.
It's good for us, but I mean, you know, we have to make sure that governments and companies can't monitor the Lightning Network with ease. You know, we have to make that really hard for them.
Yeah, that's the NL big conspiracy that Matt Odell, my co-host on RHR, is always talking about. He thinks there's a potential for Ellen Big, who has, I believe, 50 of the top 100 biggest Lightning Network nodes.
Mm-hmm. Just sell his services to the highest bidder.
Well, that they're trying to become as connected as possible to the network to be able to track it, right? On Lightning in particular, you have these channels open with most of the nodes. You can probably.
So, what's the way to defeat that, folks? Is for all of us to start getting involved, right? Yeah.
No, that, and then use Tor as well. So we've made our Lightning Network node, it's running through Tor now, but another thing with that is we need Bitcoiners to run Tor relay nodes as well. Like, if we expect Bitcoin to leverage Tor, we need to contribute to Tor to that network as well.
I think this is interesting because that is a fear, you know, the fear, especially, I think, from, and you hear this from folks, certainly folks in the Monero community who are more concerned, but like that Bitcoin will become a surveillance tool. And I think what's kind of interesting to me is that we have this idea of like voter apathy in the United States, where like, my vote doesn't count. Like, nothing I can do can make a difference. Well, it couldn't be more different with Bitcoin. Like, you need to go, you know, everything you can do personally to, whether it's use Tor or add to the decentralization of the network, makes a difference, right?
Yeah, no, and then on top of that, so like adding to decentralization, so I like to delineate between decentralization and robustness. So like robustness, I think of the ways in which you can send Bitcoin, and I think that's an imperative problem to tackle as well, and that's what I wrote about in the Bent this morning, was TX10M Blockstream Satellite's recent announcement that you're going to be able to send Bitcoin transactions via a mesh network and propagate it via satellite, so you never have to touch the internet, which I think is huge. A good plus, like, if without that stuff, that type of stuff, internet service providers would definitely be able to censor the network if they were ever coerced.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, and we need to work on infrastructure, but we also need to work on design and usability. And maybe that's a good seg into the Open Money Initiative. Mm-hmm. And some of the work that the Human Rights Foundation is proud to sponsor, that Jill Carlson and Alejandro Machado and Jamal Montasser are doing, by doing design research, going into the field in this particular case, working with Venezuelans who have escaped from Venezuela, who are living in Colombia, and trying to understand how they are sending and receiving transactions with family, like how they're accessing money around the world. And it's pretty amazing that they're doing this with an eye towards design and usability. And I think that's key, because at the end of the day, if it's just a small group of people, I mean, think of like something like PGP. Like, if it's kind of hard to use and kind of a pain, it can only have a limited effect, right? So if it's easy, if it's just like a swipe, and if it's done with usability in mind, then that's how we can really get this thing going. So definitely happy to point you guys to that direction.
Yeah, check out the Open Money project. Shout out to Alejandro Machado, TFTC alum. But I pulled up the app. I'm not checking text or anything. I want to show you the Zap app, which I think is a huge step forward in UX, like running a Lightning Network node in particular. Like, I've set up the tftc.io website a couple weeks ago. We launched it, and we're trying to make it like a closed-loop Bitcoin system running on Lightning and Bitcoin, obviously. But it's, if before this app, in my mind, like, I would have had to be at my computer at all times managing channels,
right?
And being to be in a central location to do that. The Zap app has made this experience leaps and bounds better. You scan a QR code, you're immediately connected to that node. And I had to run errands the weekend we were launching the site, so I was on the go, and I was able to open channels, create liquidity on the go. It's very easy, and you're talking to somebody. Even though I'm a Bitcoiner, been to Bitcoin for a while, I'm not the most technically apt Bitcoiner. And
And look, hopefully the Open Money Initiative folks and other projects like it can help us understand like what people actually need in these broken financial systems, so that we can provide them stuff that the average non-technical person can use and make a difference in their life. I mean, I think that would be something that I would be happy to hang my hat on. Like, already we've started to collaborate with local Bitcoins, and started to talk to them about some of the challenges that people in Venezuela, for example, face in accessing it. It's not like super mobile friendly, for example. So, like, if we could do more of that, if we could work with them, and we are through the Open Money Initiative doing that, hopefully we can get easier access to their peer-to-peer marketplace through mobile, and that would be a really cool achievement. So I hope to like replicate that around the world with some of the work that I'd like to do at HRF moving forward, that I hope you all can get involved with and check out at hrf.org, or write to me on Twitter at Gladstein, GladSTEIN, or by email if you want at alex@hrf.org.
Definitely reach out to Alex if you guys are interested in any
Please
of this.
Please do.
But like, from a, I forgot what I was going to say, from a UX perspective, I think replicating tendencies that people are already used to, like topping up minutes on a burner phone or something like that, especially in countries where that's usually poorer countries where that's more common, stuff like that, replicating those experiences, but for Bitcoin. So that's why companies like Azteco and GetBitter in Europe appease me, because it's a sort of simple UX where it's, hey, give me money, provide an address, and you get Bitcoin sent to you.
No,
right,
we need
away.
It. Like, at the end of the day, folks are all too eager to trade their freedom for convenience. We just have to know this. This is like a sad human trait, right? So we need to make sure that the stuff that preserves financial sovereignty and privacy, you know, that this Bitcoin tech is easy to use, like, and is simple to use, and is a swipe and not something where you have to look up some ID and log into this thing and do this other thing. No, it should be really simple, because it needs to compete with WeChat, basically, at the end of the day. Like, if Bitcoin globally is going to be that, like, day-to-day financial way that you interact with people, it's going to have to be really freaking convenient. And what's given me hope is that it actually could be, because it could be faster than any centralized option. Like when you watch how fast Lightning works, right? You get glimmers of this, right? I mean, obviously, it could be a lot better for privacy. You know, we know that. But again, like, people don't really care about that so much. They care about speed. Are their friends using it? Is there network effect? Is it fun? So people making this stuff have to really think about, well, what made like early Facebook and like what made Instagram a few years ago and what made like what makes Twitter now and, you know, like in its golden age, I would argue, and like what makes WeChat right now so awesome? We really need all of that into this Bitcoin architecture and in these Bitcoin and Lightning apps is so critical, or else just not enough people are going to use it. It's like one of the problems with Signal. It's like you try to make like a group chat on Signal. It takes like 5 minutes. It's ridiculous. Right. And I love Signal, but like, come on, man. Like that stuff's got to be better than the centralized solutions. That's the only way we can ensure that hundreds of millions of people will get on board, right?
No, I agree. I'm optimistic. I think it's getting better. And it takes time. Like, we need to build out the infrastructure. That's like another big theme on Tales from the Crypt is like patience is key. In my opinion,
it is.
Things are a lot further than I ever expected them to be at this point. But also, you need to have that. You can never be complacent. You've got to have that sense of urgency, especially when the stakes are as high as we've been talking about for the last hour now. Like the stakes are very high. Like and you described this in your talk on Saturday. Like there's two roads in that one chart where you. Describing the
centralized digital money.
Yes,
ends inevitably in something like WeChat. Like, yes. It ends in some sort of like all-encompassing app that is like your social network and all your other apps in one, and it provides the government a super easy way to track everything that you do and control your behavior. You need to own up to that. That's reality. That's going to happen. Now, we have an escape valve. We have a alternate reality that was provided to us by Satoshi Nakamoto. And we need to do what we can with it. And, you know, if we don't give enough attention and investment and tender love and care and whatever, you know, it's just, it's not going to work out so well for us, I fear.
Why do you think people are so afraid of governments and afraid to, that's the notion or the belief that I have is that a lot of people think, oh, why even attempt to take these guys on and take freedom back into your own hands.
Well, like, governments have usually a monopoly of violence in their particular territory, which of course is intimidating. But I think people just need to look at history of humankind and understand that people have forced governments to do things they didn't want to do. I mean, there have been many amazing, peaceful, democratic revolutions which have brought power to the people at the expense of tyrants and kings and military juntas. There have been incredible innovations in technology, again, ranging from the printing press to the telegram, to the internet, which have basically forced the hand of governments, even though they control the means of violence. So, like, technology can be our friend here if we use it the right way. And we have to, because as sort of Yuval Noah Harari has pointed out, like, most technology is very amenable to authoritarians. Like, most technology that seeks to collect and analyze data at scale, whether it's, you know, AI, big data analysis, whatever you want to call it, automation, et cetera, like, that's going to be used to kind of like keep the status quo where it is. But there's other kinds of technology too that can give us sovereign money and give us private money and give us ownership over our own data and give us a way to privately communicate with each other and give us a way to have decentralized access to the internet and give us a way to have seamless, you know, anonymous payments. And that's the stuff that I think people that care about human rights and democracy need to be thinking about. You know, people complain a lot about democratic erosion all the time, whether it's in obvious countries like Turkey or Hungary or, you know, the Philippines, or whether it's here in the United States. But like, at the end of the day, to properly prevent the erosion of our, you know, basically constitutional republican democracies from sort of fading into authoritarianism, we need to be able to check their power, right? And we need to be able to own our stuff and, you know, own our rights and property and money and data. And I think Bitcoin gives us a pretty exciting foundation to kind of put this idea of liberal democracy on life support, at least for another few decades, because it's under threat, man.
It really is. And it's another beautiful thought that you just incited in my head too, is like Bitcoin allows you to act on these. Like, so Occupy, you made me think of Occupy Wall Street.
Sure.
During your last spiel, like Occupy, like I remember I was a freshman in college, just coming out of high school.
Yeah, this is the real Occupy Wall Street.
Exactly. So like people, I remember the intensity of Zuccotti Park and
right.
how intensely that was covered and the emotions behind the people that were
very emotional.
Were involved in Occupy Wall Street, and like nothing got accomplished by Occupy Wall Street.
This is the way you can physically like take over your own stuff and remove it from the control of elitists and bankers.
So this is, right? But it takes action. Like, how do we get people to act? How do we
education? Mm-hmm. And you know, again, I mentioned this to you earlier, but you know, someone came up to me the other day and was like, "Well, maybe you all shouldn't be talking about this. Maybe you're blowing our cover, right?" But at some level, I disagree. I think we need to spread the word. You know, whatever. We don't need to go tell. We don't have to go tell the governments, but we need to tell the people. And this is important for me because I work with all these, you know, anti-corruption journalists and investigative reporters and dissidents and activists. And I want them to at least know about Bitcoin. I want them to know it's an option. I want them to know what's happening in the Bitcoin ecosystem. I want them to know about all these exciting conversations about the importance of private money. I want them to know where we are with the surveillance state, and I want them to be like up to speed so that they don't fall behind. You know, I want them to have the edge informationally, educationally on corporations and governments.
I'm curious, have you observed that some of these people from more oppressed countries sort of get Bitcoin more innately?
They get
it quicker?
Yes. So like, for example, I was sitting down with my friend Ivan Mawire, who's like a super well-known democracy advocate from Zimbabwe. And I sat with him and I talked with him very briefly about, hey, there's like this decentralized digital money that your government can't like control or debase. And, you know, instead of being like, well, like, oh, I've heard it's like a scam or whatever, like most Americans or Europeans immediately say, he was like, oh, that's really cool. Tell me more. And I, you know, said a few more sentences and he was like, you know what? Like, I'd love to learn more because that has literally destroyed my country. And he actually took out from his shirt a necklace that he wore, and he showed me that he wore a dollar from 1980 from the Zimbabwean economy on his neck. And he said that a lot of the activists in the Zimbabwean movement wear this as a sign of what their economy used to be before their government hyperinflated it out of existence. And that to me was like really powerful.
So one of the first guests on Tales from the Crypt was a man named Za, who I used to work with at Barstool Sports, and he's from Zimbabwe.
Uh-huh.
And he explained to me like he lived through that hyperinflationary
just the scenario. Government robbing all of your stuff.
The thing that led to that was they kicked out the farmers, they confiscated their land, and then.
Well, and this helps folks understand that like authoritarianism and tyranny, you know, are completely connected to money and to the economy. I mean, we talk about this idea of separation of money and state,
well,
right?
Zah was talking about like the black markets that developed in money. Like he paid his high school tuition via in cattle. Like that's, and is cattle and gasoline turned into like the most used currencies when the crisis was at its height, which is crazy to think. Like you're paying for high school and cattle.
It's definitely bad for a authoritarian government to be able to control the means of production of money with no checks and balances. And this is what, you know, people make fun of the Fed a lot. And I think we need to definitely like, you know, be very careful with that and sort of like, criticize what they're doing and hold them accountable. But at the end of the day, it's actually like good that the president of a republic cannot like arbitrarily just tell the Fed what to do, right? And you'll see this in any major...
We see our president trying to do that via Twitter
now. And it was amazing. I was observing this a few months ago where Trump was basically like, hey, like we should do more quantitative easing and whatever. And it's very good that he can't just do whatever he wants. And I'll never forget this conversation I had with a Turkish friend of mine. This was maybe 5-6 years ago. And he was telling me that at the time, the vice president of Turkey had been caught with a money printing machine in his basement. And this isn't like, oh, we can make jokes about, oh, well, the U.S. government
has basement
plenty of
money. Because the house got like raided by, the house got raided by like insurgents, right?
We're not talking about a metaphor of like, oh, like we go and we print more money like federally.
You're talking about his legit
house.
He
had a money printing machine in his house, in his like basement. And he was just like printing a bunch of money. So that's the level of direct control that these authoritarian regimes have over money. And what you need to just envision is like as he's pressing that button and printing those bills, he's just stealing from everybody who's saving, right? Like this is what's happening. It's literally their savings is being just slowly eaten away, right?
That's a very heavy entrenched power that Bitcoin is.
Yeah, they can't do that anymore.
But like, are they going to go down quietly?
No, they're going to strike with a vengeance. Mm-hmm. I think Eric Voorhees said this the other day on Twitter, where he was like, they're going to be curious at first, and then they're going to push back a little bit, and then they're going to be pissed. Yeah. You know? And we haven't reached that level yet. I mean, only, what, 3-4 countries in the world have claimed to, you know, without enforcement, of course, but claimed to ban Bitcoin. Like, we're not there yet. They're largely either not threatened, they don't care, or not that interested. In 5 years, it's going to be very different. So we need to, like, batten down the hatches and work hard as we can right now while the window of opportunity is open.
Yeah, luckily the average age of a politician, at least in the United States, is like 63. So it's like, I have hope.
Yeah, and hopefully hope that they won't be able to catch up. I mean, what we can hope is that young politicians, regardless of where they are on the political spectrum, and my goal is to hope to convince some of the more leftist and progressive politicians that Bitcoin is friendly to them, because it allows them to help break this monopoly that's arbitrary of elitists and sort of Davos-like Wall Street folks over money. My hope is to try to sit down with them and explain this to them so that they can be more open to this, because I view this as a very democratic, progressive force, right? And I think, you know, obviously someone like Andrew Yang seems to be open to that. But, like, I don't see any reason why any of these young, sort of very liberal, in American terms, I guess, politicians, I don't see any reason why they should be against Bitcoin. I know why they would be, unless we got involved and tried to have conversations with them. I know that some...
Why would they be?
Why would they be? Because I feel like if we don't get out there and have meaningful conversations about what Bitcoin is and what it represents, it can be easily misconstrued as some, like, very right-wing libertarian, you know, thing with, like, people who have tinfoil hats and want to end the Fed. You know, like, I think the Ron Paul movement, you know, is pretty not helpful for, like, most people when we're trying to convince folks about like how
it's
money systems
should be. Not the most convincing argument.
He's not very convincing for many different reasons, including foreign policy. And I think there's a strain of thinking in the Bitcoin land, which is unfortunate. And there's some high profile folks out there who say and think this way. But I mean, you've got Bitcoin promoters out there who are, like, unabashed supporters of Putin, for example. And I just think this needs to end. Like, you don't have to think anything about the U.S. government. You need to separate that in your mind from understanding that Putin is a brutal dictator who murders journalists and kills anyone who disagrees with them. And we have copious evidence of this. And he's murdered so many people in Chechnya and Syria and in Ukraine. And this is a guy who's just totally bent on destruction. And if you believe in Bitcoin, you cannot support Putin. I don't think you can do that with a moral conscience. And yet there's, like, quite a few people that I've met, maybe not quite a few, but certainly a few high profile ones in the Bitcoin space who seem to be, like, chummy with Putin.
Really?
Not cool.
See, no, it's not cool at all. Like, Putin's a fucking scumbag. He's a statist. He's a dictator, basically, at this
point. I'm not going to name names, but think about it as you follow folks on Twitter and as you digest their podcasts and... Just this is a red flag. I mean, this means that they aren't pro-freedom in the end. They might be anti-American, but they're not pro-freedom. These are two different concepts.
Right? No, that's like, that's the...
Like, these people, when I push these people, they're basically like, the reason we like Bitcoin is because it'll end the dominance of the dollar in the world. I'm like, okay, to what end? Like, so that the Chinese or Russians take
exactly,
over?
Exactly. That's the scary, like, gray area where it's like, I'm not anti-American. Obviously I'm not anti-American. I fucking love America. I live in America. I will fight for America till the day I die. Right. I just think that the world would be more efficient. The economy would be fairer.
Yeah, but these are folks who, like, hang out in America, enjoy American liberties, and then they go trash America, you know, and that's something that, like, just needs to be addressed.
Yeah.
I think you need to be, like, a responsible American citizen and understand that our government is causing great havoc in the world in certain areas, and we need to, like, try and push our politicians and business leaders to not do those things. And as Americans, we should use our rights and liberties to, like, be in solidarity and help folks abroad and promote the Bitcoin network and work on Bitcoin, because a lot of folks in the world, you know, can't openly do that in the same way, right? So let's, like, use our liberties, but let's be very clear that, like, if you are interested in the Bitcoin project and in financial privacy and in financial sovereignty, you are, you know, welcome to the anti-authoritarian club, let's put it that way.
Fact.
Which means that you need to really be careful about, like, folks who are warm or favorable to, whether it's the Russian authoritarians or the Iranian authoritarians or the Chinese authoritarians. Like, any authoritarian is bad. And, you know, this is something that Christopher Hitchens basically coined was this idea of like principled anti-totalitarianism. Doesn't matter what religion, what geographic location, what language, anyone who's like a hardcore dictator, it doesn't matter what politicians they support,
doesn't
or
matter
where
if
they fall on American foreign policy, you should be against them 100%.
100,000%. Like,
so this drives me nuts with the code pink people.
Putin has poisoned journalists with like the nuclear.
The worst excess of this is code pink, right? So code pink picks and chooses. So they're like against properly, rightly, like let's say America's role in Yemen, but they're like fighting and they're like against any sort of positive, potentially, like anything we could do to help Venezuelans. Like they're taking over, like basically, they're trying to basically say that like any sort of attempt to support Venezuelan opposition is somehow like American imperialism, and there's nothing more arrogant than that. Like, these people are fighting their own battle for freedom. They don't need like Code Pink to tell them that they don't deserve it. You know, there's these literal YouTube videos you can watch of interviews on the street in DC of Venezuelans getting yelled at by these like white American gringos, right? Like you and me, who are basically standing there being like, no, like, you know, we should continue to support Maduro, the socialist, like, you know, like just, you know, your guy's just a crony for Trump or whatever. This is just couldn't be further from the truth.
Right.
So this is really, really frustrating. So I think like if you're into Bitcoin and you're into like financial privacy and freedom, be very careful. Like that means you should be against all dictators. They're all bad.
Being ideologically consistent is important.
You should try. I mean, it's very difficult to do, but like I'm certainly not perfect, but you got to try, you know?
No, and it goes back to what I was saying earlier about like my Iranian friends. Like when I think of like Iran, I think of them. I think of those individuals. When you think of Russia,
what about the Palestinians?
When I think of Russia, I think about my boss Dmitry, who is a Russian, and he talks about how terrible it was living under the Soviet Russia, and like that's who you think. Like, and that's what I hate so much is that politicians in general, any politician, any country, whether despotic or free, like America. Like, I just think they never have. Like I think politician as a mechanism is outdated for today's society, and it's just a naturally centralizing force, that role of politician.
Well, at the end of the day, like Bitcoin's going to be this tool which is going to remove the power for these governments to make arbitrary decisions. I mean, again, just think about the Palestinians. Like they're very restricted in what they can do. Their banking and finance movements are very controlled, right? This is going to be a tool for them too. So I think anyone using Bitcoin needs to understand that anyone being repressed by anybody is going to be benefited by the spread of this network, just like the open internet.
Yeah. And I think it just, what we need now at this point is more people to have the courage to step up and join the fray. Right. And
hey,
I think that's why
build, do whatever you can.
Alex, I want to ego stroke here right now. Like I think, like I do think, like that's why I like.
Thanks, Marty.
That's why I like your pieces that you put out in Time and your presentation from Saturday, because it's legit. Like I can send that to my mother-in-law, to my sister-in-law. Like this is why Bitcoin's important, and that's something that they emotionally connect with. Is I think the framing that you have for Bitcoin's freedom enabling perspective
and
is.
Look, I think Bitcoin as it is today, you know. Like the token, the protocol, is the key thing. But it's actually more of an idea, right? That we can all rally behind, which goes beyond the value of it today in U.S. dollars. That's important for the network security, and it's important because we need to like on ramp more people and have more adoption, and you know have it be a more safe and stable ecosystem. But at the end of the day, it's this idea that people can be financially sovereign and that people can be hopefully eventually financially private, and that we can have like a really powerful tool against the Orwellian surveillance state.
How exciting is it being a part of it? Like it's invigorating waking up every day, writing about this stuff, like being at the fore, like you said, during the Manhattan Project, that was the smartest minds in the world, like picked by the U.S. government Uh-huh. Bitcoin is just naturally coalescing. Yeah,
people just coming together.
Right?
It's really exciting. And I try to share it with as many people as possible. And I'm sure, just like you, I come off as annoying or whatever. but I hope folks get it. And I know that it took me a long time. It took me many, many months to understand. Probably 7 or 8 months before I started to really start to click. And I have to give a shout out to Andreas Antonopoulos because mm-hmm. he really helped me understand all this. If you just listen to enough of his talks and videos, you'll start to really get this.
What was your biggest hurdle initially?
Well, the biggest hurdle is that at the beginning, there's no good educational materials, and it's all about blockchain and what is a blockchain, and you have to work through all this stuff. And for like a person who's, you know, used to doing kind of like Wikipedia style just research, it's very confusing. There aren't many great educational materials. A lot of the more technical materials are too confusing for the average person. And a lot of the like for the average person stuff is not Bitcoin specific and sends you down like a rabbit hole of something else, you know? So I will say, like, at least right now, it seems to take a lot of commitment and interest to actually start to grasp Bitcoin in that deep way. And I'm hoping that we can create better and better and better educational materials so that that time commitment can be decreased, so that within several weeks or days or whatever, folks can start to really understand this, because that's going to be key.
No, I completely agree. That's why I think things like the Open Money Project, like working on the UX, even not even the UX of using it, the UX of explaining it. And that's like a problem I've been trying to solve with like Marty's Bent and this podcast, is how do you distill this message? And it's not easy, but I think we are getting better at it as a quote unquote community. And I think for reasons that you just described, being more specific, not talking about blockchain, talking about Bitcoin.
Yeah, let's talk about Bitcoin.
Yeah.
You want to talk about other stuff? Great. We can like separate that out, but this deserves its own conversation. And I believe for the reasons we've laid out over the last hour and a half plus, that this is worthy of your time, and that even if you don't end up working on this project, that at least learning about Bitcoin, I think, will help you understand a little bit more about how politics and economics works, about how monetary policy works, about hopefully how systems and networks change, and maybe gives you a little bit of optimism. I mean, it really does give me a little bit of optimism that there's something that we can do collectively, peacefully as humans to help challenge surveillance and authoritarianism. It does give me that, right?
No, and it gives me that too. Now, going back to what we were touching on earlier, you were asking like worst case scenario, like how can this turn into like a bad future? Like, I don't think it can, because coming to understand Bitcoin means that you have more personal responsibility. You understand how your life is affected by these systems more innately, and you are able to make better decisions off of that. So if you have a collective understanding about Bitcoin, mm-hmm. you have a population that is able to make better decisions about how their life is affected.
Right. I mean, I think I wouldn't go that far. I think it's going to be really difficult to get it right. And there's a lot of ways we could screw it up. I mean, primarily by ignoring the whole thing, but also by not doing the right things with regard to fungibility and privacy and usability. There's a lot of ways we could go wrong, but it could only be better if more and more people get involved. And I hope that's what folks do. So I hope anyone who's interested in the human rights aspects of this gets in touch, and we can jam and hopefully make something happen.
Well, if any of you freaks are listening to this and you want to make something happen, don't be shy. Don't be shy. DM, email.
Come at me.
Come at them.
I'm ready.
You have to go to the Coin Center dinner tonight.
I'm going to go to the gala and support Coin Center because they do awesome work. And even in open societies like America, we need nonprofits to protect our rights and prevent regulation of free speech and private property.
Well, don't tell Beauty on that. He won't be too pumped about that. But no, it's Alex, thank you so much for coming through, man.
Real pleasure. Thanks for having me on, dude.
Dude, not even for coming through. Thank you for doing what you're doing.
My pleasure.
And again, when we're talking a lot about education, I think the pieces that you put out just from an educational perspective are great for people trying to get introduced to Bitcoin. You really drive home why it's important, especially your talk last Saturday and your timepiece. Like, really get to the core of why this shit is important.
Well, I appreciate that, and I hope more people can join and get involved and keep spreading the word, because most folks in the development world, the humanitarian world, the human rights world, haven't really thought about this at all. There's a lot of work to do. So I think everybody can play a little bit of a part.
I do as well. So start annoying everybody to start thinking about this. Alex, final here.
Uh-huh.
Final word of wisdom, parting note for the freaks. Obviously, get in touch with you. Anything that you got coming out in the future that we should be paying attention to? Last spiel.
Yeah, sure. I'll do something fairly selfish because I have the opportunity. I run a conference called the Oslo Freedom Forum, which is coming up at the end of the month. Got a lot of awesome Bitcoiners coming, like Jimmy Song and Elena from Casa, Jerry Brito from Coin Center. But the real amazing part of the event is that we have all these activists and dissidents coming from tough political environments all around the world to tell their story. And the program is all live streamed, so you all can watch it for free at OsloFreedomForum.com. On May 27, 28, 29. I guarantee you, you'll learn something. You'll be challenged. You'll be provoked. You'll be triggered. You'll be enraged. You'll be inspired. But come check out our content. And hopefully you can come to one of our events. You know, we're starting to work in some of this Bitcoin and crypto programming and thematics into our human rights programming. And we have upcoming events later in the year in places like New York and Taiwan and Mexico City. And even in Johannesburg. But I hope it's interesting for you all. So OsloFreedomForum.com, check it out, and you might find it exciting and hopefully interesting.
That'll be happening the week after Memorial Day, a day that serves to remember the people that fought for your freedom. So very, very precious.
That's right. Pay attention to the ones who are fighting for freedom around the world today.
Exactly. That's a perfect note to end it on. Peace and love, freaks.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Alex.